Hello again. Welcome back. Now, in a moment, we'll talk more about India's history. But first, here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Five countries have cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, accusing it of destabilizing the region. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the UAE and Yemen have ended dealings with the Gulf nation after saying it backed militant groups such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda. Colombia's FARC rebel group has accused the government of violating the terms of last year's peace agreement. The group says the arrest of one of their members breaks the terms of the deal and risks delaying the peace process. President Juan Manuel Santos has said the situation is being addressed. And United Nations peacekeepers have secured the town of Bria in the Central African Republic after weeks of violence left more than 100,000 people displaced. The UN force announced it would be reinforcing its positions throughout the country as fighting between rival groups continues. So it's 70 years since the partition of India. We're discussing the legacy it's left us with today. I'm joined by Indian politician and former Under-Secretary General of the United Nations, Shashi Tharoor, and he joins us with the release of his book, Inglorious Empire. Here it is, the story of what the British did to India. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Shashi.
Your book, a savage critique of Britain's colonial past in India. You say it was more like theft, the theft of India's resources.
Absolutely. I mean, the British came to what was once one of the richest countries in the world, in fact, the richest country, 1700, 27% of global GDP, and reduced it over a couple of centuries of plunder and exploitation to one of the poorest countries in the world, with 90% of the population living below the poverty line when the British left, a low life expectancy, practically no economic growth. It really was, unfortunately, a rather sad story, and I tell it with as much detail as I can muster.
Yes.
And I also take up the various arguments that have been advanced by apologists for the empire, and I dismantle them.
It's very uncomfortable reading for the British who look at this book. Did you intend it to be like that?
Well, look, it was actually a book intended much more for the Indians to begin with, because I felt that young Indians needed to know about their own past or their society's past on the basic principle of you don't know where you've come from, how will you appreciate where you're going? I was gratified by the reception the book got in Britain, because here I thought there might be some more resistance, especially since for the last 15 years or so, you've seen a lot of revisionist history being written by English historians who claim that the empire was a quote-unquote jolly good thing that laid the foundations for today's globalization and so on. Whereas in fact, it was actually, I'm afraid, a pretty unpleasant exercise of exploitation of a thriving economy and a foreign civilization in the name of other, shall we say, causes, and certainly intended to benefit the British.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the apologists there a short while ago. When we think of the empire, there is this perception that it was in some way good for the countries who were colonised. So let me put those points to you. What about the way India is today, an amazing sovereign nation? What about the rule of law? What about democracy?
Well, frankly, all of those things are precisely the arguments that I advance and that I go into dismantling at some detail. All of these are brought in to perpetuate British rule, not to advance Indian interests. Rule of law, for example, was applied with excessive attention to the skin colour of the defendant. You had a situation in which over 200 years of British rule, only three cases can be found of Englishmen being convicted and executed for murdering Indians, whereas hundreds of Indians were killed every year by the English without with complete impunity, with practically no punishment. For example, when Englishmen kicked their Indian domestic servants to death, a very common occurrence, dozens of such cases every year, they were explained away by saying, oh, these Indians are all malarial, they have enlarged spleens, and so the kick meant they died of a ruptured spleen, not of murder. That sort of justification. And of course, Indian judges were not allowed to try English defendants. The whole system was skewed.
I mean, some of the things you write about are very distressing. I mean, you've talked about famine, about lynching, about millions of Indians who died.
35 million Indians died totally unnecessary deaths because of British policy on famines, their rejection of what they considered indiscriminate almsgiving, so no charity in droughts, their insistence upon continuing to procure grain from drought-affected areas in order to feed the breadbaskets of London, their insistence on neglecting those who were literally starving to death by saying by Malthusian principle that if the land can't support the population that's trying to live off it, well, then people will simply have to die, too bad. And their refusal to give decent assistance or charity on the grounds that you can't spend money you haven't budgeted for. And all of this, which, by the way, they did in Ireland too, leading to lots of deaths during the Great Irish Potato Blight and lots of Irishmen getting into boats and rushing off to America, which was not an option available to Indians. They, unfortunately, presided over the deaths of large numbers of Indians,
so
35 million.
Why do we have this rose-tinted view, then, of how the empire helped countries like India, if that wasn't the case?
Well, you mentioned democracy, for example, but it actually had to be prized from the reluctant grasp of Britain. You mentioned United India. I'm sorry, India was actually divided by the British in perpetuation of their own control. When, during the mutiny, the revolt of 1857, they saw Hindus and Muslims fighting side by side and under each other's command against the British, they said this mustn't be allowed to happen again. So they got rid of the Mughal emperor, under whose banner these people had fought, and they insisted on a policy of divide and rule, whereby they tried to create a sense of separateness amongst the Muslim population in order to divide them from the Hindus. And this resulted in the tragic partition of India in 1947, which had 1 million people being killed, 13 million displaced, one of the largest refugee movements of all time, billions of rupees of property damaged. The fact that after all of this and all the oppression, the arrests, the discrimination, that India emerged and remained a thriving democracy is to the credit of Indians, not of the British.
And do you, I mean, is it all bad? I mean, today, do you not think that the Brits and the Indians have a special relationship? However bad the history was, do we not have a special relationship today?
You know, we're linked together by useful things like the English language and a fondness for tea and cricket. But whether you're going to make that into something that we should celebrate beyond the fact that today, of course, India treats Britain on the basis of two sovereign equal nations. The Indian economy is large as the British one. We can deal with the Brits without a chip on our shoulder about it. But the fact is that the 200 years that went before, the exploitation, the drainage of resources, the massacres and brutality, the deaths and the famines, the racism and oppression, all of that is a fact of life. I'm not asking Indians to keep dwelling on it. We should definitely move on.
Because we have to look to the future
now. I'm saying let's forgive, but let's not forget.
Because, as you say, India, a thriving economy, a powerful sovereign country, and a country that the British are now looking to, hoping to make trade deals in the future when they come out of the EU.
Well, the old terms of trade from the colonial era will not be available. This will have to be a trade discussion with give and take on both sides.
Well, between two equals, as you've said.
Exactly. I mean, the fatuous talk about Empire 2.0 appalls me, because Empire 1.0 was such a bad idea.
But I don't think the UK sees it like that.
And no,
certainly
these are some civil
servants, government
would
see it like that. But what they're hoping for is to look to former allies like India, former colonies, to hopefully make some kind of deal that they can rely on post-Brexit. Do you think that that is possible?
That's possible, provided Britain understands that other countries, the Commonwealth countries they want to do this trade agreement with, can only give what they've got to give in return for Britain selling what it wants to sell. So, for example, one of the issues that has become politically very important in India is visas for Indian students, including the right to stay on and work for a year or two, gain some experience, put some money in the bank before coming back. Right now, we've gone down from 30,000 Indian students in the UK in 2010 to just 10,000 this year, at a time when even Australia attracts 45,000 Indian students a year and the US attracts 135,000. The only difference being the extreme tightness of British visa issuance policies and the unwillingness of Britain to allow Indians to stay on and do some work and training.
This is leverage that India has.
So this is what it's got to be. So if Britain relents on those areas, India may well relent on more Scotch whisky. I don't know.
As we look towards the future, and books like yours obviously pushing to the fore the kind of legacy that the British Empire has, how do you see the relationship going forward now?
Well, I think going forward,
I mean, do you want Britain to apologise, for example?
Well, I do. I don't think it's going to affect the political relationship, but since so much was done in the name of the Crown, if a member of the royal family wanted to come to India, for example, on the centenary of the single worst atrocity of the British Raj, the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, or the Amritsar massacre, as it's often called, which took place on the 13th of April 1919. So the 100th anniversary is just under 2 years away. If somebody were to come and say that this was a terrible thing and that I express on behalf of the royal family contrition and remorse for what was done on this occasion and by extension all the wrongs over 200 years, I think it would go a long way to cleansing the sin that otherwise stains the history of the relationship.
Shashi, it's been great to speak with you. Thank you very much indeed for that, and good luck with the book. Shashi Tharoor there.
Thank you, Shirley.
Now, we end with our insight bite, a little something that we feel you should know. Now, populations of these African penguins have been falling catastrophically. According to scientists, the decline is directly linked to climate change. Researchers tagged 54 young penguins from 8 colonies in South Africa. They found that temperature change is causing the penguins to move east and look for food in the wrong places. Overfishing is also a problem because it's leaving fewer fish in the water for penguins to eat. That's all for now. I'm Shirley Ghosh, and that was Insight.